Good evening, everyone, and welcome to tonight's Commonwealth Club program. Tonight's kind of a special occasion for many reasons. We're having a member social event this evening, and we're also combining it with a little bit briefer than usual panel discussion and celebrating the book launch, the launch of a book that was based on a series of programs at the Commonwealth Club last year. So the Commonwealth Club is almost 110 years old, and in that period of time, only three externally published books have ever come out based on Commonwealth Club discussions and programs. So this is number three. We're very excited about it. It's a book called The Real Problem Solvers, Social Entrepreneurs in America. It was based on a series of talks and discussions last year with over a dozen people who have founded organizations and programs to solve social problems, address needs in our society, but applying new ideas, entrepreneurial approaches, business approaches, and who have blazed a path to deal with problems in a new way. They're called social entrepreneurs. The book, the series and the book were put together by a person who is a social entrepreneur herself. That's Dr. Ruth Shapiro. Ruth has degrees both from Harvard and Stanford. She's founded organizations. She founded an organization actually starting out here at the Commonwealth Club, just with some office space and her innate energy, called the Asia Business Council about, 12, 13 years ago, which brought together CEOs of companies in Asia and companies in the United States to discuss common issues and problems. The first group that had really done that in that way. So she herself is a real problem solver and a social entrepreneur. She's done a fabulous job. She put together a series of some really amazing leaders and then convinced Stanford University Press to publish the book coming out of it. So Ruth Shapiro, we're celebrating tonight her accomplishment, the successful series last year. We have several of the series speakers and authors of parts of this book here with us tonight on a panel. Ruth is going to lead a discussion. For those of you who don't often attend Commonwealth Club programs, this is a taste of what we do at the club. Happy holidays, since this is also a holiday gathering. And Ruth, congratulations, and congratulations to each of your panelists and the social entrepreneurs on this accomplishment and also what you do every day.
Thank you.
Over to you, Ruth.
Thank you, Gloria. And thank you, everyone. So I was living abroad for 6 years, and when I came back to the Bay Area, I started pretty much describing myself as a social entrepreneur. And a number of people said, I don't think so. You're not really a social entrepreneur for various reasons. You created an organization. It's in Asia. It's with wealthy CEOs. They don't need any help. And one person even said, you're too old to be a social entrepreneur. That was the last straw. So I say in the book that I thought, well, so if I'm not one, what is it? And I thought I knew, but I did a little experiment. I walked down University Avenue in Palo Alto, and I asked 10 random people, excuse me, do you know the definition of social entrepreneur? And out of these 10, 7 of them said, isn't it some kind of business on Facebook? And I thought, aha! There are really people who don't know what this is in addition to myself. What can I do about that? And since I'm quite fortunate to be very close to a wonderful person, Gloria Duffy at the Commonwealth Club, I was very good friends with her even before the Commonwealth Club, I was able to approach her and ask her if I could put together this series. Then, with some help from the Kellogg Foundation, the Skoll Foundation, and the Omidyar Network, I was able to bring 13 of leading lights in the field here to the club to talk about this field and really give perspectives on the field as a whole. I wanted to address the ecosystem around social entrepreneurship in addition to the social entrepreneurs. So before I tell you what the key findings are, let me just thank first the Commonwealth Club and the wonderful staff and the board, and especially Gloria, for helping provide the platform for this book. The funders that I just mentioned, certainly the contributors, and we are so fortunate to have four of them here, and I'll introduce them in a minute. And my husband, Michael, who's somewhere in the audience. He's back there. I met Michael in 1986. He was working for this little startup NGO, just a few people, called Ashoka. That's one of the reasons I thought I knew what social entrepreneurship was. It goes way back. But I learned a lot in this process, and I learned how much this field has evolved. So let me just say, since Bill Drayton of Ashoka coined the term social entrepreneur in 1981, there's been a lot of thinking and energy and creativity in this space. When Bill first coined the term, the definition was someone who brought the passion of an entrepreneur to address a social problem. Since then, it has evolved to include business rigor, business tools, technology, and in some cases, incentives like profit, and to address social issues. And by bringing all these different, essentially business tools into the mix, what's happened is an explosion of creativity, innovation, and enthusiasm that are changing the way social change gets done. Some of the key differences are the blurring of profit and nonprofit, leading to innovative new models. And I think Matt particularly is going to, I think, maybe mention some of those ideas tonight. There's impact investing, there's social impact bonds, there's B corporations, there's a whole range of new models and innovations, hybrid investments that are trying to address social issues in different ways. There's been an increased measurement and focus on impact, leading to increased efficacy and scale that has never before been seen in the field of nonprofit and work in the last 20 years. That's just really exciting and important. And all of these new changes have brought in talent and excitement unparalleled, especially among young people, which is why I think I got the old age comment. But there is a lot of energy, vitality in the field, and it's very exciting. The book moves beyond the entrepreneur to showcase the people, the organizations, and the perspectives making up the whole ecosystem around social entrepreneur and innovation. And I really wanted to get multiple perspectives who are moving the field forward. So we're very fortunate tonight to have a number of those perspectives represented here with the people who are on the panel. And let me just say, it's no coincidence that 4 out of the 13 contributors are from the Bay Area. There's a lot of resonance between social entrepreneurship and the DNA that makes up the area of Northern California where we work and we live. We are risk takers. We are tenacious. We see out of the box in ways that really don't happen in too many other places. So it's a hotbed for activity within the social entrepreneurship space. So having said that, let me introduce Sally Ostberg, CEO of the Skoll Foundation, is working around the goal to empower, celebrate, and support social entrepreneurs. Skoll is absolutely one of the most important organizations and foundations in this space, pushing it forward and helping to elevate the quality and the quantity of people and organizations doing social entrepreneurship. To her left, Matt Bannock, managing partner of Omidyar Network, is at the cutting edge of innovation in this space, developing new ways and models to address social change. Chris Deigelmeyer is the head of Stanford Center for Social Innovation and about to get on a plane and move with her family to Burma for 6 months. Chris is bringing her great wisdom and experience to understand and explain how to scale the ideas that are emerging in the field. And Premal Shah, one of the most terrific social entrepreneurs in the planet, He's brilliant, he's nice, and he and his team have pioneered the opportunity for all of us to engage in microfinance globally by engaging on the Kiva website. Each of our speakers, let me just ask for a round of applause for these wonderful people. Each of our speakers is going to just give you a little teaser. We really want you to buy the book. And let me just say that all the proceeds from this book are going back to the Commonwealth Club. So it is a really good thing to do for all of us who know and love this organization. Without much further ado, Sally.
Thanks, Ruth. Ruth asked us to think about what's changed in social entrepreneurship and how we've changed to adapt to those changes. And so I'm going to just speak briefly about an aha that we've had at the Skoll Foundation. The headline is really that social entrepreneurs excel at something I think we're sorely in need of. Just think of our Congress and the standoff, and you'll know what I mean when I say social entrepreneurs excel at togetherness. Think of social entrepreneurs not just as people who focus on creating social value, on solving social problems, but people who do it in a fundamentally communal, social way. And they do this by enrolling the stakeholders who are most vested in the changes that the social entrepreneurs see and believe are possible. And those stakeholders range from the grassroots, people at the grassroots who may be marginalized or suffering or oppressed because of a status quo that is marginalizing or leading to their suffering or oppression, and the policymakers and the multinational corporations at the very top of the food chain. So engaging these stakeholders to really drive and accelerate large-scale change is what social entrepreneurs are really good at and what distinguishes the most successful social entrepreneurs from those who are less successful. An example to bring this to life, Mothers to Mothers, an organization that's been working in sub-Saharan Africa, started in South Africa, with a very simple model, and that is to apply a mentor-mother solution to helping HIV-positive pregnant women navigate the medical system, adhere to the protocols and the medical regimens, such that they could then give birth to HIV-negative babies. Very simple, not a big technological or complicated innovation, but a very powerful innovation. Well, they've been at this work for 20 years. They've gone from dozens to double digits and now to 405 sites where they're active, fully staffed sites, in seven sub-Saharan African countries. But that game changed in 2011 with the global plan, and this is a plan to eliminate mother-to-child AIDS transmission, and to keep mothers alive. This plan has the goal of reducing by 90% mother-to-child AIDS transmission in 22 sub-Saharan African countries. And frankly, this will eliminate mother-to-child transmission and make a huge contribution to wiping the scourge of AIDS from the earth. The game changes because direct service had been the model that Mothers to Mother had used very effectively to scale from site to site to site, from country to country, and that's kind of the way we've been thinking of scale. But this changes because the real opportunity for scale here is to embed the mentor-mother innovation in the plans of these 22 countries. And that requires a fundamental shift in Mothers to Mother's business model to go from direct service really to technical assistance. Mm-hmm. And so with that, the Skoll Foundation was able to give them an innovation investment, $2.5 million, to help them do that work, which is much more related to advocacy and technical assistance than it is to direct service. So to do this effectively, they have to build on their experience of working with these mentor mothers, they have to capture the learnings, they have to convince the policymakers, and they have to help those countries execute on the plan to wipe mother-to-child transmission from those 22 sub-Saharan African countries and make our world a safer, healthier place.
Thank you. That was great, Sam.
So first of all, again, congratulations.
Oh, Ruth. Well, thanks to you.
Wonderful. And also, it's an honor always to be. We know each other reasonably well, and it's also always an honor to share the podium here, so to speak, with our friends at Skoll and Stanford and Kiva. You guys do fabulous work. A few words. I want to sort of frame my comment in the context of conventional wisdom versus what we kind of find when we go out and engage in the world. As background, Amity, our network, we call ourselves a philanthropic investment firm. We're focused on investing in entrepreneurs and social entrepreneurs at an early stage when we believe they have the potential to scale up and impact hundreds of thousands, if not millions of lives. We've invested more than $500 million to date. And one of the elements of the model that Ruth sort of alluded to, that's somewhat original here, is that we invest both on a for-profit and a not-for-profit basis. And that leads me to my first observation, which is that, unfortunately, in our society, I think people tend to either see business as the primary driver of positive social impact and delivering wealth in society, or they tend to see business as part of the problem and the social sector as the solution. What we've found, actually, is that if you're really looking for driving massive positive social impact, that each of the sectors has an important role to play. And we've found that in our work, if we can focus on developing, first understanding the problem that we're trying to address, and then develop the right approach to that problem, that we can actually support the entrepreneurs who are positioning themselves to have the biggest impact. And that, in fact, grants and investments are complementary in terms of driving social change. One good example of this is in microfinance, which is, I think, a sector a lot of folks, not just Premal, are familiar with. And in microfinance, I think it's reasonably well understood now that in order to get that model right, there were actually billions of dollars of philanthropic money that was put into the sector until the model was, I wouldn't say perfected, but got to the point where it could scale up. And then commercial capital was able to come in and take that sector to scale. So a good example of where there's really great complementarity. And Amity, our network, we invested about $100 million in microfinance across 28 organizations, 15 not-for-profit, and 13 for-profit. And by the way, one of the not-for-profits is Kiva, that's done an absolutely remarkable job. Another example these days that we're really excited about, because people say, oh, microfinance, is that a one-off? Or is that an example of what can be done with using complementary capital? And we're seeing really exciting innovations in a whole host of areas, including mobile money, where we think, again, there's a complementary role to play between governments, not-for-profits, and the private sector. So we think we embrace this sort of cross-sector approach to driving positive social impact. The second thing where we take a bit of a contrarian view is a lot of times people say it's all dependent upon the entrepreneur. We believe that the entrepreneur, the social entrepreneur, is the primary vehicle driving positive change. But we also, I think, need to understand that the entrepreneur works in a broader context, broader societal context, a broader national context. And I think it's important to recognize that in supporting the entrepreneur, we need to support that broader context as well and understand the extent to which the entrepreneur, the social entrepreneur, is in fact influenced by the broader context. Let me give you just a specific example. We support an organization, we invest in a company called D-Light that brings low-cost solar lanterns to the poor in rural areas in the developing world. And they have solar lanterns now down to about $8 a solar lantern. It's absolutely transformational in the lives of, for example, children who can now study at night. Well, D-Light was really successful early on in Africa, less so in India. One of the important pieces of context was in India, they subsidized the use of kerosene. So everybody in the rural areas was using kerosene. There was no subsidy in Africa. So in Africa, the sales took off. They had less traction in India. And now in Bangladesh, we see that the government is actually subsidizing home solar systems. And we see a huge takeoff in home solar systems in Bangladesh. So we at Omidyar Network are taking these lessons to heart and spending more and more time not only supporting those fabulous entrepreneurs, but really understanding and engaging in the broader context in which they operate. And the third and final point I'll make is Again, the conventional wisdom focuses on how do we provide the money to the social entrepreneur. And every social entrepreneur will tell you, yeah, of course, what I would really like is the capital, the money to scale up my ideas. What we found is, yes, financial capital is essential, but that entrepreneurs and social entrepreneurs also benefit tremendously with all sorts of what we call human capital that helps them provides the insight, the knowledge, the planning to help them scale up. One good example of this at ON is we have actually six full-time recruiters who help the social entrepreneurs hire fabulous executive teams. And that's been a hugely popular offering. And just the final note on that is when we did our survey with the Center of Effective Philanthropy that reached out and surveyed all of our grant recipients, one of the questions was the extent to which they valued the financial capital we provided relative to the other forms of human capital we provided. And half of them said that the human capital we provided was as beneficial, as helpful, or more than the financial capital that we provided. So again, that's been an important learning that we're trying to integrate into our thinking. With that, I'll turn it over to Chris.
Thanks.
So it's great to be here tonight, and as Ruth talked about, how do we get social entrepreneur and social innovation to the future? And so what I'm going to highlight in our brief time together is the reality that the toughest job up here on the panel is Premal Shah sitting next to us. The rest of us have a walk in the park compared to what he has to do every day. And so the theme that I think we really need to focus on, and I'm going to talk a little bit more about, is execution trumps ideas. We've got a lot of good ideas out there, and a number of them are sitting in what we've identified as a stagnation chasm in the world of social entrepreneurship and social innovation. Given that we're all here in the valley, we know the traditional entrepreneurship world has a great valley of death. Lots of ideas, and if it's not a good idea, it dies. Those that can make it past the valley of death, we have ecosystems, we have talent systems that are built to help scale those organizations and those ideas till they can diffuse on a broad level around the world. At the Center for Social Innovation, when we looked at social innovations that had scaled over the past 30 years, what we find is they go through idea generation, great. A lot of them continue on. Most don't die. The really good ones, as we'll talk, you know, as I think Sally highlighted with Mothers to Mothers, they go through piloting and prototyping. They define their model, and they get real solutions, and then they hang out. They're not able to grow. They don't go backwards. And I think one of the fundamental problems of why we're not able to grow those great social innovations is we haven't built the ecosystem that's applicable to social innovation that's different than traditional entrepreneurship. And there's many, many levels to that. And I was sharing what I was going to talk about with a few people at work today, and they're like, oh, Chris, that's so abstract. So I'm going to narrow it down to three concrete ideas that some of our speakers have already talked about, but that I think are fundamental key changes in the ecosystem that will hopefully break this stagnation chasm. One is we need to focus on process, systems, and about efficiency and effectiveness. We need to help the Kivas, the mothers of the world, focus on their supply chains. We need to help them build great organizational learning, companies and businesses and nonprofits. We need to invest in those unsexy things that allow great organizations to scale. Matt talked about Delight. They were funded out of Stanford. And I know also the pain that Sam has gone through, and I'll be honest, it's about the supply chain. And again, ON is an exception that's a funder that will understand 5 years in, 7 years in, this is a good investment to focus on these really non-sexy things. But we need to change the mindset of individual donors, big donors, to support that. The second one, again, which Matt alluded to, talent is about everyone. Social entrepreneurs are great, and there's a piece of the great man or woman theory that we need to support, but we also need to support these larger organizations around their entire team building. And to be honest with you, ON is the only kind of large philanthropic organization that I know of that invests in the human capital. And so if you take that to scale of around the world, is really one enough. And what I would like to see is that Kiva, you know, in a few years with the right investment, has an example of a world-class entrepreneur organization that has a training program similar to IBM's. Great training program. There's a reason it's a successful company. And then the third piece is we need a new capital model. And there's a lot of, you know, excitement and I think momentum behind impact investing. And I think that's a piece of the solution to change capital to social innovation and social entrepreneurs. But there, the two fundamentals that we haven't figured out yet is how do we value the long term? How do we invest for 5, 10, 20 years, not 1-year grants, 3-year grants, 5-year grants? How do we build that continuum of investment and support? And then how, for both social entrepreneurs and traditional businesses, we change our mindset to invest in financial, social, and environmental returns. We've got to really expand that value proposition. So I think the social entrepreneur and social innovation space is in a really important juncture right now, and I think if we can innovate on some of these execution things to help move these great ideas through this stagnation chasm, we'll have the potential for real solutions for real people in actual real time.
Thanks. I think she teed you up very well.
Well, yeah, you know, I think Chris is right. I do have the hardest job on the panel because I'm coming after these three people who I greatly, greatly admire. And I have to say that Kiva is oftentimes is a success story, but it's really this ecosystem, particularly in the Bay Area, that's helped nurture it. And let me just spell out the specifics really concretely using Kiva as an example of a social enterprise. We started about 7 years ago now, and it was just a personal project. We didn't expect all of this to happen, and the founders, including myself, all graduated from Stanford, and was nurtured by a lot of the kind of professors, advisors, kind of engineering talent that kind of got Kiva off the ground. Matt and I worked together at PayPal for several years, and has been a personal mentor. And you know, it's more than Omidyar Network is Kiva's largest funder. They invested $5 million over 3 years to help us get to the next level. And now Kiva's at about 100 employees. When they invested in us, we're about 50 employees. You know, finding, it's one thing to raise money, but it's another thing to spend it wisely. And what they do to help us recruit great execs and great talent to Kiva has been just enormously valuable. So I can really attest to that. And then Sally's organization, Skoll Foundation, you know, again, it's beyond just the money. What Skoll does so well is they also tell stories and they fund the ecosystem around storytelling. In fact, Jeff Skoll, the guy behind Skoll Foundation, also runs Participant Productions, and they created films such as An Inconvenient Truth and one thing that Skoll funded that completely changed the trajectory of Kiva was PBS Frontline World. And PBS Frontline World, in October of 2006, decided to do a story on Kiva. At that time, Kiva was a website. I had quit my job from PayPal maybe about 6 months earlier. Matt Flannery, my business partner at Kiva, quit his job at TiVo. He's an engineer a few months before that. And we were running this website, Kiva, and, no one was coming to the website. In fact, the top result in Google was a spa in Santa Cruz, apparently. And I was particularly depressed when I looked in the database and I saw that even my parents hadn't used the website. You know, and they're still upset that I left for, you know, a good paying job at PayPal to go to a nonprofit. But not only that, that I'm not a doctor. I mean, it was just complete disappointment on their point. But, you know, it's hard in the early days. And there we were. Largely unpaid volunteers. It was not sustainable living here in San Francisco, especially with healthcare. And we needed to find some early funders or figure out some breakthrough in the model because we were only getting, a couple hundred people a day visiting the website. And of that, only 3 or 4% will actually make a loan. So that's just not enough volume to actually take off. And I didn't know if Kiva was going to take off. And then in October of 2006, two things happened. One, Muhammad Yunus won the Nobel Peace Prize for microcredit, overnight making it a kitchen table word here in the U.S. And two, Skoll Foundation funded this PBS documentary, which crashed our website for 4 days because we were on a $22 a month server plan. And so we put up a little PayPal button saying, you've melted our servers, help us buy new servers. And we raised $130,000 from the internet community while our website was down. And that kind of capitalized Kiva. And from that point, we had raised maybe about $450,000 in that first year. The next month, we raised $1 million on the website in $25 increments from the internet community. And now we raise $1 million every 3 days. And what's amazing is, you know, that supported about 900,000 small businesses in 60 plus countries. About 80% are women, they're posted by a network of field partners, and these are the real heroes that are oftentimes unseen on the Kiva website. But like Skoll and like Amidyar, what we want to do is empower the frontline agents of change out there with patient capital and visibility on the Kiva website, because so often great social entrepreneurs all around the world spend far too much time trying to raise capital and spend far too much money doing that. And if we can make that process more efficient and give them more visibility so that other funders can find them, then we can really make a great change together. So let me talk about two problems we're facing right now at Kiva at year 7. The first problem is a problem of the sector that we're in. We are in microfinance. And when we first started in 2006 with Muhammad Yunus winning the Nobel Peace Prize, you could do no wrong in microfinance. It just seemed like an amazing intervention with absolutely all great things and nothing negative about it. Or I was naive enough to believe that. And over the last few years, I've really got to see that there's really two sides to credit. And we saw this with the subprime lending crisis here in the U.S., which is when there is an abundance of capital flowing into the sector and the lenders on the ground aren't acting completely responsibly, you can have over-indebtedness, you can have non-transparent pricing, you can have people who basically have unfair collection practices happen to them. And there's been, in the last couple of years, several articles that have come out really kind of showing the quote-unquote dark side of microfinance. And I think it's really forced a period of reflection for not only us at Kiva, but as an industry, how can we do this responsibly? How can we actually not say, is microfinance good or bad, but how can we make it better? And what's our role within the ecosystem, and particularly as Kiva, as a website that gets as much traffic as it does? It's now the second most trafficked website in the nonprofit space behind Wikipedia. About 1 million people a month come to the site. What can we do? And what we realized is more than just the money, we can now create badges. So just like on Yelp, there are badges, and if you run a good restaurant, you know, people can leave you good reviews. We started creating social performance badges around how well are they protecting the clients in terms of pricing transparency, fair pricing that you're seeing on the Kiva website. What are they doing around wraparound services, for example, in healthcare or in education, like financial literacy? Oftentimes, some organizations do it at their own cost, but they choose to do it because it's the right thing to do, and they're really honoring the double bottom line. Opportunity Fund, for example, is in the audience today as a Kiva partner, is an example of a Bay Area microfinance institution that goes beyond just making loans and provides business education and training. By using badges, we can now give visibility to these organizations and really highlight the ones that are actually doing, really prioritizing kind of the double bottom line. And that has really changed the incentive scheme we've seen in the 160-plus microfinance partners we have in 65 countries, where at the boardroom conversation, they're saying, hey, look, on this very public website, Kiva, we only have 3 badges, and our competitor next door has 7 badges. How do we get the next 4 badges? And then what we try to do is provide them with basically what we call Kiva Fellows. They're on the ground. They're people like you and me who, between careers, might want to get a stint in microfinance. We select you, we train you in San Francisco in our office for a week, and then we deploy you to one of 60 countries for a period of 4 months to a year. It's like a mini Peace Corps program. And you can help operationalize better social performance for the microfinance institution. That's something that we've had to pivot and change with the times, and I'm really proud of that work. It's not something that's seen really visibly on the website, but I think it's really created an impact. A second example of how we've tried to make an impact and pivot with the times is Matt mentioned that a lot of commercial investment is coming to microfinance now. Well, if that's the case, and now people are lending money at 0% interest on Kiva, what's the role of 0% interest capital when there's commercial investment coming in? And what we learned is that when you go out to these microfinance institutions, they're just banks for the poor, and they oftentimes say no to things because they don't have, they perceive the risk to be very high or the cost to be very high. Let me give an example, a couple of them. The first is grace periods with farmers. If I'm a farmer in sub-Saharan Africa, there's recent research that shows that if you can just add something as small as a two-month grace period or a grace period that matches to when that farmer can get the crop, grow the crop and sell it at the market and then have them pay back the loan, there's material gains in their income. But from the microfinance institution's point of view, they feel like doing a grace period might result in a low repayment rate. And so what we want them to do is use the money that's coming up on Kiva to test things like a grace period, which we know are in the farmer's best interest. And if they fail, if it's a low repayment rate, not say a 97% repayment rate, but an 85% repayment rate, then all of us are going to share that risk, all of us who are lending to those farmers that are getting the grace period on Kiva. Another example is student loans. It's a chicken and egg problem in the developing world, which is right now banks perceive student lending, if you're in Peru or if you're in Kenya, to be too risky, and therefore no one does it. If no one does it, there's no repayment track record. No one has a repayment track record, and no one's going to want to do it. So who goes first? Well, all of us on Kiva can now actually start funding students via these microfinance institutions. And my hope and dream is that we can show that lending to an 18-year-old girl who gets an accounting degree from Strathmore University in Kenya historically shows a 98% repayment rate. If that's the case, then it's not only the direct impact of lending to that girl, but it's a demonstration effect to the local banks in the market that, hey, this is a market-viable product, and we can crowd in commercial capital, and then we can scale up the student lending industry there. So that's one of the kind of – that highlights some of the ways that we've had to pivot as we've learned more about microfinance and what it can and can't and its limitations. The second kind of struggle that we face is Kiva with – its 98% repayment rate, it's practically free. And if you lend $25, and your odds are you're going to get that back. But only 1 million people have done it. And that's a lot in the nonprofit space, but if we really want to make this change we seek, everyone needs to get involved. And so we reflected on this problem. We discovered, I think, what we have is the one penny problem. The one penny problem goes like this. The moment you ask anyone for money, everyone's got to think about it. You know, everyone kind of like, we got to give someone, people a free way to engage. And so beyond getting a personal experience connecting with someone, what we've done now is it started with the founder of LinkedIn, Reid Hoffman. He's put out $1 million on Kiva. But instead of him lending $1 million, he let the Twitter sphere lend his money. And it's really cool in that we converted those $1 million into 40,000 free $25 trials. And in the month of March, 40,000 people signed up for Kiva and lent out his money. And over the course of the year, the money will go back to Reid Hoffman. So at a 99% repayment rate, his real cost will be about $10,000. But since March of this year, that 40,000 people have already put into incremental 400,000 of their own money into the system. And so we're trying to figure out, well, now if we can make the experience free, what about arming all teachers with the ability to let their classrooms use Kiva as a geography lesson, as an economics lesson, as an empathy lesson? And so these are the kind of the constant kind of pivots or product evolutions that we make at year seven at every stage. And you know, I just wanted to let you in on kind of where we're at right now.
Thanks, Pramit. Okay, now you can see how happy I was when these four people said that they would be in this series and in this book. How it was an amazing series. It's a very good read because you get more of the thinking of these four panelists. And so I really encourage you to read it. And I think we have time for maybe two questions out of this group. Yes, ma'am. But you have to shout because we're...
Mr. Shaw, can you please bring us up to date, if you can, on the situation of the Eunice? I understand the head of the country has been trying to suppress it.
Sure, and you know, I'd invite my fellow panelists to chime in. So a few things. Dr. Muhammad Yunus has recently been removed as head of the Grameen Bank by the Prime Minister of Bangladesh. And it's something that has been seen by us and many other people as a politically motivated move, because at one point I think he was toying with the idea of starting his own political party. Mm-hmm. And we think it's an unfortunate thing for the members of the Green Bank. It's owned by its members, by the women members. Our observation from what we can tell is that this is politically motivated. He's no longer the head of the Grameen Bank. But in some ways, one observation is that it's kind of like Obi-Wan Kenobi, where he's actually in some ways even more powerful beyond just being the head of the Grameen Bank, as being one of the leading spokespeople for the social enterprise movement. And now his ideas are so much broader than microcredit. His ideas are around social business, the idea of making a non-loss, non-dividend business. And so...
Don't say too much about his ideas, because he does have a chapter
in the book. So read Ruth's book to get the latest. But that's what I know.
Okay. One more. Yes, ma'am. Oh, yes, sir. Sir, do you have a... But I want you to ask a cue right now. Okay.
I would like to know whether any of you have thought of that as a way to empower the audience when you're talking to intelligent people, whether or not that's something that you think would contribute to getting people interested and involved.
I think that... at the Commonwealth Club, there are many opportunities to engage in discussion and discourse, and we just decided to set up this format for tonight to maximize our time together. But thank you very much for that comment, for that C. And now I'd like to just again thank the Commonwealth Club, thank my fellow panelists. We will be around. We're happy to sign books, and... I really want to thank you for being supportive of the Commonwealth Club and for us. So I was going to... We are at the Commonwealth Club. So ladies and gentlemen, tonight's program is adjourned.